The last chapter of my PhD thesis contained my first singularity theorem. This showed that under certain reasonable conditions, any cosmological solution of the field equations would have a Big Bang singularity. At this singularity, classical general relativity would break down, so one could not use it to predict how the universe began. It was therefore necessary to develop a quantum theory of gravity in order to understand the origin of the universe. We are still working on this problem, and haven't yet reached a definitive conclusion. But in this talk, I want to explore if the origin of the universe can be semi-classical and non-singular. This is possible despite the singularity theorems, because like so many other no-go theorems, they have a get-out clause. In this case, the get-out is a strong energy condition. The strong energy condition is the inequality on the energy momentum tensor that ensures gravity is attractive in any frame. It is satisfied by the Maxwell and Yang-Mills fields and by the gauge field of 11-dimensional supergravity. Thus, it is not possible to avoid cosmological singularities in purely classical M-theory. On the other hand, a scalar field, or quantum corrections, can violate the strong energy condition. I shall therefore investigate models with a scalar field with an effective potential that includes quantum corrections. I shall take the effective gravitational theory to be four-dimensional, because we have no observational evidence for extra dimensions back to the period of inflation. At this time, any extra dimensions must either be compactified smaller than the Hubble radius, or be part of an Andy D. Sitter space, on which the universe lives on a three-brain. In either case, the effective theory is four-dimensional. An example would be trace anomaly inflation. This can be regarded as four-dimensional gravity, coupled to the quantum effective action of a large number of light matter fields. The trace anomaly will generate an effective cosmological constant, which can give De Sitter space as a self-consistent solution. YADS, CFT, the quantum effective action of the matter fields in the four-dimensional spacetime can be calculated by taking the spacetime to be the boundary of ADS 5. This means trace anomaly inflation is more or less the world sheet theory of a stack of D3 brains. There can be other four-dimensional effective theories that do not obey the strong energy condition. I shall therefore discuss theories with a scalar, phi, and a potential, v. In order to end up in nearly flat space, I shall assume that the scalar potential has a minimum at, or very near, zero. I shall say that the potential belongs to class A if it has a local or global maximum, which is not too sharply peaked, that is the second derivative is below a certain bound. Potentials with a maximum that is more sharply peaked belong to class B. Potentials without a maximum belong to class C. Historically, potentials of class B were used in the old inflation scenario. The potentials were of class A in the new inflation scenario, and of class C in chaotic inflation. In this talk, I shall be concerned with potentials of class A, with a broad flat top maximum. In the original new inflation scenario, it was supposed that the universe started off at a singularity, as a hot Big Bang model. As the universe expanded and cooled, the scalar field was supposed to be left balanced on the peak of the potential, from where it would slowly roll down the potential, causing inflation. This mechanism of placing the scalar field at the peak of the potential always seemed implausible and was clearly unsatisfactory in invoking a previous hot Big Bang phase to explain the Big Bang phase we are in. For these reasons, new inflation has therefore quietly been abandoned over the years. However, Hertog and I have shown recently that an initial hot Big Bang phase is not necessary. If the potential is of class A, the dominant contribution to the amplitude for an inflationary universe comes from histories in which the scalar field starts on the peak of the potential as a four-sphere or Hawking-Moss instanton. The reason is that the constant scalar field saves more in gradient energy than it pays in potential energy for being at the top of the hill. The picture is therefore that the origin of the universe is a four-sphere, which I shall call the P. it will be in the semi-classical regime, if the potential at the maximum is small compared to the Planck value. In this case, the evolution of the universe will always be semi-classical. We won't have to worry about space-time foam, or Planck-scale physics. In the trace anomaly model, the force sphere will be the boundary of the ball of ADS-5. Thus the key has a squashy middle. The force sphere or key can be analytically continued to a de-Sitter space. However, it is an unstable de-Sitter space because the scalar field is balanced on the maximum and will roll down. The roll down breaks the O5 symmetry of the force sphere to the O4 of the Friedman models. Thus it arises from scalar perturbations of the force sphere. The lowest P equals zero mode is O5 symmetric, so it doesn't contribute. The P equals 1 mode shifts the force sphere sideways, so it is just gauge. Thus it is the Euclidean P equals 2 modes that give the initial conditions for the roll down in the Lorentzian regime. An O4 P equals 2 perturbation will change the force sphere into an ellipsoid. This can be analytically continued from its equator to a closed Friedman universe. The universe would initially expand like de-Sitter space, but then would change to matter or radiation-dominated expansion as the scalar field rolled down the potential. One could equally well analytically continue in the opposite Lorentzian time direction to obtain the time reverse of what I have just described. Joining the two together gives a universe that contracts, bounces, and expands again. In this respect, the P universe would be like pre-Big Bang scenarios, such as the ecdoteric and cyclic universes. However, the causality is very different. In pre-Big Bang scenarios, one starts the universe in an ordered state, in the infinite past. As the universe evolved, departures from the ordered state grow with time. It is claimed that these perturbations can be continued through the Big Crunch Big Bang to the expanding phase, where they give a scale-free spectrum of fluctuations. In these models, the arrow of time always points forward, and disorder increases with time. This is because they are specified by an initial state, or boundary condition in the past. On the other hand, although the T-universe can be analytically continued to a Lorentzian spacetime like the ekpyrotic universe, the causality and arrow of time are different. The boundary condition on the universe, that it has a closed Euclidean section, is imposed at the bounds or minimum radius in the middle, rather than in the infinite past. This means the arrow of time, the direction of time in which disorder increases, points forward in the present expanding phase, but backward if one analytically continues back to the previous contracting phase. This explains how the T-universe manages to contract, bounce, and expand again without a singularity. If one specified the solution by initial conditions in the infinite past, it would require incredible fine-tuning to achieve a non-singular bounce. But with the boundary condition at the bounce itself, it is automatic. By contrast, the ekpyrotic universe has a real fine-tuning problem to ensure the perturbations remain small back to the Big Crunch, Big Bang. Personally, I expect the perturbations will always diverge as the universe collapses, and will make it impossible to continue to the expansion phase. Maybe the only way to get a solution sufficiently well behaved, that one can match perturbations from the contracting phase to the expansion, would be to impose a boundary condition of regularity at the orbital point. But then the arrow of time in the contracting would be reversed, so perturbations would decrease with time rather than increase, as they are supposed to in the ekpyrotic scenario, and one wouldn't get the scale-free perturbations that are claimed. To get back to the no-boundary universe, the scalar field will start at the maximum, and will roll down to the minimum. It will overshoot the minimum, and oscillate about it. The energy in these oscillations will be converted into radiation, and will heat the universe. The first and second derivatives of the potential determine the parameters, epsilon and eta. The roll down will be slow, in the technical sense, if these quantities are small. Inflation will end when epsilon equals 1. The exits from inflation can be divided into two classes. I shall say the exit is near maximum if the second derivative, eta, is negative, and that the exit is near minimum if eta is positive. Inflation can continue to near the minimum only if the separation in phi of the minimum and maximum is more than the Planck mass. Such large fields might seem unphysical, but they can just be artifacts of the canonical normalization of the second derivative term in the action. Observationally, a near minimum exit will be similar to the chaotic inflation scenario. The quantities we can measure with WMAP are the amplitude and spectral slope of the scalar modes. They will be compatible with the WMAP results, provided the potential near the minimum is like that of a scalar with mass 10 to the 14th GeV. Such a potential will occur in the trace anomaly inflation model if the coefficient of the R squared counter term is about 10 to the 10. This potential would give a tensor amplitude of about 10% of the scalar amplitude. This would be too weak to be detected by WMAP, but it might be measurable by the Planck satellite. It would be a clear signal of inflation with a near minimum exit, but it would tell us little about the origin of inflation. Did it start at a semi-classical maximum, as I have proposed? Or did it start at the Planck density, as in the eternal inflation scenario? On the other hand, a near maximum exit would allow us to see back almost to the origin of the universe, which would be non-singular. The upper limit on the tensor amplitude from WMAP would imply the height of the maximum was less than 10 to the minus 10 of the Planck value. So the origin of the universe would have been firmly in the semi-classical regime. How can we distinguish observationally between a near maximum exit and a near minimum one? The best bet seems to be the ratio of the tensor and scalar amplitudes. In a near minimum exit, epsilon, the steepness of the potential will increase steadily to 1, and will be comparatively large when the scales we observe leave the horizon during inflation. On the other hand, in a near maximum exit, epsilon will be small until it suddenly becomes very large, as the scalar field falls over a cliff in the potential. The value of epsilon at horizon crossing will therefore be small. The ratio of tensors to scalars is epsilon at horizon crossing divided by asterisk. I would take a measurement of about 10% tensors as strong evidence for inflation with a near minimum exit. Less than 5% tensors would be evidence for a near maximum exit. Some people would claim that low tensors are evidence for the ekperiodic or cyclic universe. However, I find the treatment of the brain collision unsatisfactory, and I don't think I'm alone. So it is not clear how much its predictions can be trusted. To summarize, because of the singularity theorems that Penrose and I proved, people assume that the origin of the universe must have involved Planck scale curvatures in physics. If this were indeed the case, it would be very difficult to give a proper treatment, even with string theory. However, I have shown that it is quite possible that the curvature was never the Planck value, and that the universe was in the semi-classical regime. All our treatments of string theory or M-theory are based on the semi-classical approximation. The 6 or 7 extra dimensions of spacetime are assumed to be compactified as the classical Calabi-Yau, or G2 spaces. So why can't all 10 or 11 dimensions be semi-classical? In that case, the origin of the universe would be a Euclidean P in 10 or 11 dimensions. How can we determine whether the origin of the universe is semi-classical or not? The trace anomaly inflation model seems to be compatible with WMAP. However, the exit from inflation would be near minimum unless the number of light matter fields is very large. A near minimum exit would mean that we wouldn't see back to the start of inflation. So it would be difficult to tell if it was semi-classical. trace anomaly inflation, should probably be regarded as a toy model of a non-singular universe. Presumably, it should be extended to include quantum corrections in higher dimensions as well. We don't know yet if that will allow a near-maximum exit, so we can see back to the beginning. But it is only if the origin of the universe is semi-classical that we can hope to understand it. So let's hope the Planck satellite enables us to determine if the universe is non-singular. So much for my PhD thesis.